Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome to Talking Tudors, Episode 1. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk about Tudor palaces and historic sites is author Sarah Morris. Sarah is an historical researcher, author, and blogger. Her books include Le Temps Viendra, a novel of Anne Boleyn, In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn, and In the Footsteps of the Six Wives of Henry VIII. Online, she is known as the Tudor Travel Guide. Her blog, of the same name, is the intimate visitor's companion to discovering Tudor England. Sarah loves researching and writing about places associated with the Tudor era so that her followers never leave a Tudor location again thinking, if only I'd known about greatest Tudor loves, Anne Boleyn, reading original Tudor documents, and writing about lost Tudor buildings. Definitely a woman after my own heart. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Sarah. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me. Oh. I am very honoured to be here.
Oh, thank you. Now, you and I know each other well, but would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yes, of course. Actually, I've got a little bit of a strange background, really, that's not initially to do with history. That comes a little later. But anyway, so believe it or not, I started my career as a medical doctor. Although, sadly, the demands of the job after a few years caused me to burn out, actually. I left medicine and I worked in the commercial world for a few years. And then finally, I began to follow my other passion, which is a lifelong passion for personal development. Yeah, I'd say I'm a pretty curious soul and inquiry and growth. And I know you're the same now.
Yes, we're very similar, aren't we, us two?
We are two peas in a pod, actually. So, you know, kind of growth and personal growth is a bit like the air that I breathe for me. It's just part and parcel of who I am. So that passion led me into being my current career, which I call my main job, which is as a coach. And I've been working for the last 15 years running my own business as a leadership and organizational development coach and consultant. So no history yet. What happened? Well, I suppose, you know, 2010 was probably the key year for me. Until that point, my kind of love of history had been very much a private affair to be enjoyed from the comfort of my own sofa with a good history book.
Yeah, sounds good.
Or you know, weekend trips away to enjoy, see historic properties. And that is something I've certainly been doing since I was sort of knee-high to a grasshopper. And then in 2010, my first book, Le Temps Viendra, a novel of Anne Boleyn, sort of happened to me. And I use that phrase quite deliberately. I wasn't planning on writing it at all. And that's when things changed.
Yes, definitely. And so what was it exactly then that sparked your interest in Tudor history, do you think? What made you, you know, sort of get off the couch and the private history lover to a more public sort of passion, I suppose?
Yeah. So I've thought about this often, and I suppose I have my parents to thank really for my deep love of history. As I just mentioned, you know, as a child we spent most of my weekends and holidays going around stately homes and castles, and I think it probably could have gone one of two ways. I either would have rebelled and refused ever to set foot across the threshold saying historic property again, or it'd get in my skin and I'd be hooked for life. And I think fortunately it turned out to be the latter. And then, of course, you know, learning about the Tudors in secondary school here in England really kind of honed my my love, and some might call it obsession, with Anne Boleyn. And you know, then over the Tudor period in general. But as I said, it was really the kind of the writing, or the beginning of writing, of Le Temps Viendra in 2010 that just submerged me deeply in the Tudor world, and I began to go online as I started to research about the book, and researching contemporary stuff, making contacts in the Tudor community with people exactly like yourself.
Yes, I was just thinking, I think that's, I'm pretty sure it was 2010 that we met, that I think I messaged you on Twitter because I saw your profile that said you were writing a novel of Anne Boleyn, and I had been running on the Tudor trail for about a year then, and I remember thinking, oh, wow, this sounds so interesting, and I reached out to you, and the rest is history.
The rest is history. I think I've been stalking you silently a little bit on probably on the internet before then. But yes, no, it was the rest is certainly history.
Fabulous.
So really, that's what got me going.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Now, I know that over the last sort of decade, you've spent a lot of time researching and writing about places associated with the Tudors. Mm. But what do you think inspired you to tell the story of the Tudors through this particular lens?
You know, I have to touch back on this thing about visiting ancient castles and, you know, ruins. And, you know, you and I have discussed on many times, you know, there's no doubt that while people have come and gone, you know, their lives, their tastes, and, you know, all the events, etc., the buildings themselves still survive. And they're like, you know, they're physical reminders, a physical connection to the past and those people. And, you know, I think if the circumstances are right, I really feel that there's sometimes this felt sense of the past. And that really helps me to bring the events and the people alive in my imagination. And, you know, that was something that I lent heavily into as I was writing Le Temps Viendra, when I really needed to kind of get really deeply into the feel of Anne Boleyn, into her mind and soul. And so I think it was doing that really made me realize how important places are. And that's what really caused me to focus down and start to work with you on writing the In the Footsteps books.
Absolutely. And we've been really lucky to have gone on many historical adventures together. And we've walked in the footsteps of all the prominent personalities of the day. And when we talk about locations after we've visited, we often talk about a place's historical vibe. Could you explain to our listeners what this vibe actually is that we're referring to?
Yeah, so I'm smiling. I've got a really
weird. I know, I've got a big smile on my face too.
Because, you know, I know there are many times when we've gone on these shared visits together that you and I have looked knowingly at each other.
Absolutely.
And just know, and I know what that look means. It means it's got the vibe, Sarah.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and as far as I can remember, we pretty much always feel the same place about it. You know, it sort of has the vibe or it doesn't.
That's right.
So what does that mean? So as I said, I think for me, it's this felt sense of an energy. Of people or events, and it's almost like that energy is imprinted in like the bricks and the mortar of a place. But what I find really funny is that you actually can't predict whether it's going to be there or not. So it's certainly I don't know about you, but for certainly me, it's not to do with the size or the grandeur of the place. You know, there's been many times where, you know, I visited houses that are, you know, fully intact and furnished with lots of Tudor stuff, but can feel nothing.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
very
so
beautiful.
True, isn't it?
Yeah, like it's beautiful, but I don't feel it. And then other times I could wander across a field with a few earthworks or, you know, ruins of an old abbey, and it's just singing to me. So it's mysterious, isn't it? Mysterious forces are in play, and I've got absolutely no way of explaining it. But it's definitely a phenomenon, and I'm sure that some of your listeners out there, if not most of them, will have felt this for themselves if they've visited these places.
Absolutely. I think I agree with you. There is a sort of mystery about these places, and this might be a good time to confess that we like to caress ancient walls, Sarah.
Oh, how could you out me in this way, Natalie?
Sometimes even we're known to kiss the wall. But but we'll leave that till a little bit later. Yeah. So in your opinion, Sarah, and I know this is such a hard question because people ask me this all the time, and it's like sort of picking your favourite child, which is impossible. But what are 5 must-see Tudor sites, and why? If you can sort of take us through that briefly, what are the top 5? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure about briefly, Natalie. I'll try and be brief as possible. You did give me a bit of a heads up on this one. And as you say, I was like, oh, my gosh, do I start? But, you know, I think what I'm going to do is talk about 3 pretty well-known locations and why I think they're significant. And then maybe 2 that are a little bit more off the usual Tudor trail.
Okay, great.
So I know you're going to agree with me when I say that if you're interested in Tudor history, there's only one place that has to be on your list, and that's Hampton Court Palace.
I was smiling before you even named.
Yeah, I know it's one of your personal favourites.
It is.
But really, you know, if you want to get up close and personal to Henry VIII and his wife and the court, there is just nowhere like it. And even despite half the palace being Georgianised, I know that's not a word, that's just one of my little words there, you know, enough remains for any eager time traveller to get an intimate sense of what one of Henry VIII's great houses really looked like, both above and below stairs. You know, I think you'll see one of the finest Tudor great halls in existence, and you get a real feel for some of the other key spaces in a Tudor palace, like the great watching chamber and the privy council room and the chapel. And that's even before you get downstairs and you've got those amazingly preserved Tudor kitchens, which usually, by the way, have a lovely roaring fire and the reenactors are busy doing their Tudor cooking, which is fantastic. And then, you know, the wine cellar and that complex of corridors, which once would have swarmed with activity of the servants keeping the cogs of the everyday court well oiled. I mean, it's just so atmospheric. You know, I suppose my top tip there is if you do see any of the reenactors around, they are absolutely wonderful. They'll keep in character. And if you choose your own Tudor character, you can go up to them and you can really have some fun. So I really would urge anybody visiting, if they do see any reenactors there, to go and get in role and really take up the vibe of the place. Mm-hmm. So that's my first one.
Okay, great. Started off fantastic. Okay.
Now, we're still staying in the London area for the second one, and that's Westminster Hall for me. And the reason I specifically say hall and not the Abbey, because it took me too many years to even realise, I'm ashamed to say, that Westminster Hall actually existed. I was so focused on the Abbey. But, you know, it's got the largest hammer beam roof in the country, and it's completely breathtaking. And I just remember walking in those double doors at the end for the first time, which is kind of the main entrance, and just feeling completely dwarfed. And, you know, it was just one of those jaw-dropping wow moments.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then, of course, other than the building itself, it's the historical significance of the place. I mean, Westminster Hall has just stood witness to so many key moments in Tudor history. You know, we've got the coronation of Anne Boleyn and the trials of Sir Thomas More and the men who were accused along with Anne Boleyn in May 1536. And you can actually, I think, if I remember rightly, there's a plaque on the floor for Sir Thomas More's trial. Here stood Sir Thomas More.
Yeah, I believe so.
And you go and stand there and you can imagine the stands on either side and the noise and just how intimidating it must have been. It really gives you a lump in your throat. So that's my second recommendation.
Love it.
Okay. And then, of course, how could I, as a faithful servant and lover of Anne Boleyn, not talk about Hever Castle? It was impossible, wasn't it, really?
No, of course. Yeah, I would agree.
So, you know, Hever Castle is just nestled in the lovely Eden Valley in Kent. It's just so picturesque. And if you do love Anne Boleyn, it is just, you know, the must-go-to place. And, you know, we talked earlier about vibe, and for me, Hever just oozes vibe. Can sometimes get a little bit busy in the height of the tourist season, but if you do what we did, Nat,
I'm laughing, just thinking whether we should share our little A little story.
Why don't you share our story for a moment?
Oh dear. Okay, look, I'm going to interrupt just briefly to share. I think Sarah and I could do a podcast series just about the funny things that have happened to us while researching places. But so we were visiting Hever Castle 1 year, and we know that it can get extremely busy, and it is difficult to feel that vibe when there are literally hundreds of people around you. So we thought, well, why don't we book a private tour? Let's go all out. Let's just the two of us in the castle and the tour guide. We just loved that idea. So we went ahead and we booked the private tour, and we made our time, and we arrived, and we were so excited. And when we turned up, the lady that met us had quite an odd look on her face, wouldn't you say, Sarah?
Yes, very.
And she said, oh, okay, hello ladies. We said, oh, hi, we're here for the private tour of Hever Castle. And she said, but where are the tour buses? So they were, instead of expecting just Sarah and I, they thought that we were in fact two tour buses rather than just two crazy individuals booking a private tour of the castle. So we laughed. Oh my goodness, we laughed
a
lot. And we still laugh, and that was years ago. And yeah, it's just one of the many funny things that have happened to us on our historical adventures. But I'll pass back to you, Sarah.
Yes. I will say, though, I just recently inquired with Hever. The tour prices, I think, are still quite manageable. I think it's about £40 per person. So again, that's a top tip for visiting Hever.
Yeah,
if you want to go and really get the vibe on your own without the crowds, book yourself in for a private tour. They run before the castle opens, I think, before 11 o'clock. Anyway, that's a bit of a detour there.
I like that. That's a great tip. Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously, Hever is iconically the childhood home of Anne Boleyn. And, you know, the castle was almost completely renovated by the Astor family in the late 19th and 20th century. But, you know, it still retains such a lovely, warm feeling, and it's got such a wonderful energy that it just whispers to you of the Boleyn family coming and going, doing their ordinary business, and maybe the not so very ordinary, imagining the king arriving through the gatehouse and into that cobbled courtyard in his pursuit of Mistress Anne. But I suppose, apart from the fact that it's so iconically associated with Anne, for me, Hever does hold a very special place, because it was actually, after one of visits, I was there with my friend in August 2010, and I was experiencing this very vibe that I talk about. And afterwards, we went and had a picnic on the lawn, and I just got this idea for a 21st century woman who was passionate about history and Anne Boleyn being drawn back in time and into the body of Anne, and experiencing Anne's life unfolding through her kind of 21st century eyes. And LTV, or Le Temps Viendra, was born. And so that Hever Castle has very, very special memories for me. But anyway, apart from that, it's just a wonderful place to visit.
It sure is.
So that's my third one.
Okay, and
actually, we're still on Anne Boleyn for my fourth one. But we're hopping across the channel. So we're traveling to France.
Excellent.
And as you well know, I was had the privilege of researching the French locations for In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn, and I travelled to Paris and the Loire Valley to do so. I mean, all of those are interesting, but I would pick the Château d'Amboise in the Loire Valley as my fourth recommendation.
Okay.
I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful place. And sadly, the original palace, which is actually situated high up on a plateau overlooking the river, is much reduced. Only about 20% of the original complex stands. Mm-hmm. However, you know, we're quite lucky in that the wing that does stand basically contained the French equivalent of the Great Hall and the public and private chambers of Francis I and his Queen Claude. And the King's chambers, which are on the ground floor, are kitted out in the Renaissance style. So you really get a feel for what the privy royal chambers would have looked like during Anne's time. And so it really sort of, you can imagine the young Anne, teenage Anne, there in attendance on Queen Claude, and you start to get a real feel for the environment in which she was brought up in. So what struck me was just how different the interiors are. So I'm thinking particularly of Hampton Court. It feels quite heavy and dark with all these dark oak interiors. But in the chateau of the Loire, you know, it's very light, it's beautiful light coloured stone, all the windows are thrown open, there's this beautiful warm breeze during the summer, and there was such a joie de vivre about the place, and I can just I just began to understand why Anne might have had such fond memories of her time there.
Right, yes.
Yeah, and then you can put into context, you know, that some of the important people that Anne surrounded Anne during those formative years, such as the indomitable Louise of Savoy and the future Marguerite of Navarre, you know, the great Renaissance minds like Leonardo da Vinci, who happens to be buried in the chapel, actually.
Oh, how wonderful.
So, yeah, it's a really, it's a lovely kind of bonus.
Yeah, that's right.
bonus, yes. And so, yeah, once I'd visited those places, it was really the first time that I felt had a good understanding of the forces that sort of shaped Anne's character and her tastes in religion, in books, in music, etc. So if you are really a keen Anne Boleyn fan, it's fascinating to explore the Loire Valley. So I would highly recommend that.
All right. Wonderful.
So I'm on my fifth one.
You're on your fifth.
And we're back here in the UK for that. And this is actually Haddon Hall.
Ah, I love Haddon Hall. It's one of my favourites too.
I know you love it. And I love it because I think Haddon is actually an example of a fairly, you know, perfectly preserved medieval Tudor home in miniature. You know, you get when you visit it, if you're interested in the architecture and the structure and the way the rooms are laid out, you get to see all the features of a fashionable Tudor house of its day. So you've got the central courtyard that leads via a porch into this beautifully warm great hall. And I think when we were there, the fire was lit.
It was beautiful.
Really brings the room to life. And then you've got this, at Haddon you see the true arrangement of how an original hall would be. So you have the screen at the lower end with the corridor leading down into the medieval kitchens, which are really amazingly well preserved.
They are quite amazing, aren't they, those kitchens?
They are amazing, aren't they? Yeah, I mean, I'm not usually that interested in the below stairs stuff, but I really enjoyed looking around the kitchens at Haddon. And then at the high end, you've got this access to the parlour and the staircase going up to the privy chambers, which is kind of, you know, that's where the lord and lady would retire after dining at the high end of the hall. And so you get to see how that arrangement would be. And over and above that, it's just got beautiful interiors, amazing panelled rooms. And then, in my opinion, Haddon has one of the finest and most pleasing long galleries in England.
Oh, it's absolutely outstanding, isn't it? It's just...
It is.
My goodness.
It really is, isn't it? Yeah, I was really shocked at how beautiful it was when I first saw it. And I kind of... found it hard to tear myself away.
That's
actually
true. I know, I think I took about, I don't know how many videos and about 100 photos which I'll put on the blog so people can see. And sorry to interrupt you, but Haddon also has the most beautiful chapel.
Oh yes, it does, doesn't it? I hadn't mentioned the chapel, but there's lots of really original old medieval stuff in there, isn't there?
Yeah, I felt really like, you know, that we've been talking about the vibe. I felt a very strong vibe in there, and almost like I think you'd left to go and do something, so I was just in there on my own, and I just sort of could picture, you know, a Tudor person coming in and going to prayer, and it was just just so beautiful.
And I think so, you know, I think the reason why I've picked Haddon is you know, the Tudor time traveller has got a lot to learn from the hall about that layout of a grand Tudor house and the real, you know, some of the genuine interiors. So, yeah, highly recommended. And that's in Derbyshire, of course, I think.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I just had that one of those moments where I'm thinking,
yeah, that's
it?
Right. We're like, who, what?
Definitely is.
I love your five, Sarah. Your five are fantastic.
Oh, I could have gone on forever and it could have been, I don't know, 20 or 30, 20 but yeah, let's 40. Draw a line under that.
Now, you've already touched on, I wanted to talk to you about some of the key features, because in our research, we very quickly discovered that the houses and the palaces, there were certain key features that we found in all of these grand stately homes and palaces. You've touched on some already. Was there anything you wanted to add to that about the key features?
Oh yeah, there's certainly more that we can say about that. So before I dive in and maybe explain what some of those key features are, I'd like to say just a couple of words about why I think it's interesting.
Yes, please.
Yeah, no. So I mean, just remember before I started researching and writing for our books, you know, I'd go to these places and I'd get a guidebook and I'd wander around and I'd enjoy the rooms for sure, you know, but it was all just quite superficial. I didn't really know what I was looking at. I couldn't really read the building. And then, you know, having now researched and written about a lot of Tudor buildings, what you begin to realise is that any aristocratic house of the period conforms to a certain pattern. And when you understand that pattern, you can see more. And I emphasize the word see more. And, you know, particularly if the house has been what I called with messed around with by later generations of owners, and you're interested in getting a feel for how it would have looked originally, you know, you can then start to see things and interpret things and make sense of how those rooms would have originally been configured and used. So that's why I think it's really interesting and useful. So let me think. So in terms of maybe describing some of these key features, you have to bear in mind that, you know, the actual number of the rooms would vary depending on the size of the importance of the house. So the larger aristocratic houses, palaces, Henry's palaces, obviously would have many more rooms than a smaller manor house. But nevertheless, you can still strip down to a sort of a basic structure. And that's what I'll focus on. And I'll maybe focus on somewhere like, you know, Hampton Court, one of Henry's palaces, which I wrote about in a recent blog, to just maybe describe some of that key features. So, you know, you would usually enter in through a great hall, and the halls always had a lower end, which was the service end of the hall. And there was usually a screen, which made this kind of passage called a screens passage. And that screened off the hall, usually from three doorways that would lead, usually the central one to the kitchen and then the pantry and buttery on either side. By the way, I'm sure some of your listeners already know this, but I will confess my ignorance. I actually thought a buttery was where they kept butter.
It sounds like it. I don't know why they need to confuse us.
But actually, it's where they kept the butts of wine. There you go. You continue, live and learn all
exactly.
the time.
Exactly.
Yeah, but actually, these three doorways that I was talking about have unfortunately in a lot of places been lost over time. So you might not see those. You know, I was there at Penshurst Place last weekend, and the kitchens and the buttery and pantry had actually been swept away completely, although they'd managed to preserve the three doorways. But even that is sometimes lost. So that's the lower end of the hall. At the upper end of the hall, you'll often find a little raised stone platform called the dais, which is where the lord or the king, the queen, the lord, the lady, his family would have sat and dined. And in the largest of palaces, like Henry's palaces, that would then lead through into another large room called the Great Watching Chamber. So again, you can think Hampton Court here, where the Great Watching Chamber still survives. And here literally, you know, guards would watch over the king or the queen, depending on which side of the palace you were on. So it's important to say that whatever was going on the king's side was usually replicated in the same set of rooms and lodgings on the queen's side. So you hence had the king's side and the queen's side. Now, the Great Watching Chamber, you know, it was sometimes used for ceremonies and events, but mostly these would take place in the next chamber, which was directly adjoined to it, called the Presence Chamber. And usually you would have two guards standing guard at the presence chamber. And whereas pretty much anybody could get into a great hall or a great watching chamber, you usually had to be of a certain status to be allowed entry into the presence chamber. And that would be the last public chamber of the palace. And largely you would see the throne sitting under a canopy of estate, usually with a carpet on the floor. And you know, nobody was allowed except the king or the queen to be under that canopy of state or to step onto that carpet. And so it was this, the use of the room was usually around public ceremonies or audiences, and sometimes dining. But as I said, this was the last public space. Beyond that, particularly in the early years of Henry's reign, it did change a little bit later on in his reign, but in the early years of Henry's reign, it was the last public room before entering the king's private chambers. And what you would usually find is a short corridor which acted like an airlock. It was like a physical break between the king's public and private life. And beyond that, there would be the privy chamber, which in my mind is a bit like a modern day lounge. You know, it was, yeah, it was a place to kind of relax and meet with honoured guests. You know, I could imagine them in the evening playing cards or dice, listening to music, etc. And then beyond that, I remember, of course, Nat, that as we go through these rooms, they're getting smaller and smaller and smaller and progressively more intimate, with increasing levels of control in terms of who can get access to the king or the queen. But beyond the privy chamber, in the largest palaces, there may have been another withdrawing chamber, but let's just stick to there being the bed chamber. And again, in some very large houses, there was almost like a state bed chamber where there would be a bed of state. For example, I think Windsor had that arrangement, Windsor Castle, during Henry's reign. The king didn't sleep there, though. There was then a second bedroom that led on from that, and that would be where the king actually slept. And then just maybe just one more thing to add about kind of the common arrangement of rooms is that very often, I talked before about there being a king and the queen's side, and very often those two sides would meet in the at the private end of the chambers. So there'd either be a connecting bedroom or a gallery that would connect the king and queen's private apartments. So obviously they could, the king could visit his wife with a certain degree of privacy without the whole court knowing about it. So I mean, the only thing to say really is that, you know, smaller houses had the same kind of configuration, but for example, you might move from the great hall directly into the solar or withdrawing room rather than being a great watching chamber or a presence chamber. So in other words, you would be missing some of the great ceremonial rooms that you find in Henry's larger properties. So you can see it varies a bit, but there's a basic template, and once you've got the basic template, you can start to work it out for yourself, and it certainly increased my enjoyment of visiting places.
Absolutely. It's so important, isn't it? And I think also just popped into my head that we discovered quite quickly that early on in Henry's reigns, the king and the queen's apartments tended to be stacked, and then that became kind of old-fashioned, didn't it? They thought, no, that was sort of yesterday's look. Now we're going for the on the same level and meeting, like you just said, meeting at a certain place.
That's a good point. And Hampton Court is great for that. The original wing, Wolsey's palace, which actually you can't visit all of those apartments, were stacked. And then, of course, when Henry redeveloped them for Anne, he ended up doing the modern version.
The modern version, that's right. Fantastic. Thank you so much. That was great. Now, you talked a little bit. I wanted you to talk to me a little about the Tudor royal interior. Now, you've touched on the chateau in the Loire and kind of, you know, what that felt like in that interior. What were the Tudor royal interiors like in these sort of stately homes and palaces and castles?
Yes, well, probably a little bit very opulent and probably a bit gaudy, really, by the standards of today. Definitely. A real clash of colours, a riot of colours. But let's have a think about that. So in terms of the floors, they might be tiled. I was just mentioning that I was at Penshurst Place last week, and their great hall is covered in 16th century terracotta tiles, which are, you know, wearing pretty well, so they're obviously pretty durable. But in the more high status rooms, you would probably get coloured tiles, and I know I think it's the picture of the family of Henry VIII, which is supposedly been painted with a backdrop of Henry VIII's presence chamber in Whitehall. You can see these very brightly coloured tiles on the floor. If not that, wooden floors, but very often the floors were covered in rushes, mm-hmm. of course, that were scented. And I suppose this was a way of, you know, keeping the floors as clean as possible and making the cleaning of the buildings more easy and covering some of those more distasteful scents that were associated with Tudor palaces. Maybe we won't say much more about that. Yeah. So those were the floors, and most of the rooms, of course, you know, there was a lot of oak panelling, plain panelling or linen fold panelling, which is a certain type of pattern of panelling. So let me just think what I was just about to say then. I've just lost my, yes, that's right, what I was going to say. Yes, so a lot of the rooms would be panelled or, mm-hmm. and or if not, hung with tapestries.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
So, of course, the tapestries themselves were hugely expensive. And so you'd only have the richest folk in the kingdom being able to afford those, particularly those that had been spun with gold or silver thread. And I mentioned carpets earlier. So, of course, we think of carpets being on the floor, but their carpets were also hugely expensive. And they were actually often displayed on tables or sideboards and not placed on the floor at all, with the exception, perhaps, as I've noted, in the presence chamber under the canopy of the state is one of the places I've heard of carpets actually being on the floor.
That's right,
which seems rather strange to us today, but there you go. And then in terms of maybe some of the decoration, it was obviously of a particular style. So the Renaissance, you know, saw the flourishing of the grotesque style with patterns that kind of related back to ancient Roman and Greek cultures, and geometric patterns were also common. And so you'd find those carved into wooden panelling or into the ceilings. Mm-hmm. And give me a moment. Into the ceilings, and they would be and often they would be greatly gilded, so there would be a lot of gilding of that panelling. And again, actually, if you do look at the family of Henry VIII, the portrait, you can see just, you know, the riot of colours and the amount of gilding that has gone on to decorating the you know, the walls, the pillars, and the ceiling, etc.
Excellent. Yes, I often wonder, I don't know that I would have liked the Tudor interior very much. My taste these days is quite muted colours, and that's definitely not what you got in the Tudor palaces.
No, I mean, it's all very shabby chic French country cottage, isn't it now?
Exactly, yes, I love that. Now, something that you and I have written quite a lot about is the Tudor Royal Progress. We both absolutely love these progresses. They were quite magnificent. Can you tell us a little bit about this annual event?
Yes, so the Royal Progress. So, we have had a good time writing about progresses, haven't we?
And
particularly,
absolutely.
We wrote about the 1535 progress of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII for In the Footsteps, which was great fun, really informative, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, being able to follow the court from place to place, it really built up a picture, which was I found fascinating. But so the annual progress, of course, took place regularly during the summer months, and I suppose, you know, the only reason it might not take place might be war or illness or mm-hmm. pregnancy. Not the king, obviously, but there is an example of the latter in 1533, when Anne was heavily pregnant during the summer months, and she remained at Windsor while the king went off and only did a mini progress mm-hmm. through some of the home counties around London. But, you know, the progresses took place for a number of reasons. Of course, it allowed the king and court to escape disease, plague, which would, you know, most likely flare up in London during those hot summer months. And you know, we mentioned smelly palaces.
Yes.
It also gave plenty of opportunity for all those principal houses, you know, along the Thames, which were used during the rest of the year to be thoroughly, thoroughly cleaned. And of course, from a propaganda point of view, you know, the progress allowed the king or queen to be seen by their subjects. And And finally, and I think this comes through loud and clear when you start researching any progress, the progresses were definitely for pleasure.
Absolutely.
It was copious opportunities for hunting and hawking amongst some of the finest parks in the country. And of course, much, much, much time was given over to general merriment. And I know you and I regularly were unearthing entries in the letters and papers of Henry VIII saying that the king and queen were merry, usually in Hampshire. But there you go.
That's right. That's the place to be, Hampshire. If you want to be merry, visit Hampshire.
Merry and Hampshire. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the itinerary was usually published in advance of the progress. And as we found out in our research, it could head off in a number of different directions. Sometimes it seemed to go south through the southern home counties. Mm. And then other times, and perhaps more commonly during the periods we were researching, up north towards Oxfordshire and Northamptonshire. And probably with a couple of notable exceptions, like the 1540 progress to York or the 1535, we think we call it the Reformation progress. When they headed north, Grafton was often the most northerly and popular point for progress. And along the way, you know, the court visited many of the king's properties, but they also lodged with favoured courtiers. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly true during the Reformation progress, you know, when we saw the supporters of Anne Boleyn and the reform, you know, courted along the way, the likes of Sir Nicholas Poyntz at Acton Court and Sir John and Lady Anne Walsh at Little Sodbury Manor, who, by the way, were the aunt, as you well know, were the aunt and uncle of Sir Nicholas. Mm. The other, of course, abbeys and priories were often another favoured destination. And when they were visited, the king or queen would be lodged in the abbot's lodgings, which were the most high status lodgings in the building. So naturally, they would be given over to the monarch. And that was, of course, before the dissolution of the monasteries. And thereafter, Henry had a problem because some of these places that he'd grown used to lodging in were obviously dissolved. And Henry's solution to that was to requisition some of them, like he did at Rochester and Dartford and York. And he preserved at least part of the abbey, usually the abbot's lodging, into what often became known as the King's Manor, and therefore was able to be used thereafter. So that's a bit about progresses. But, you know, Nat, I wondered whether, you know, since we've enjoyed writing about progresses so much, whether now might be the time to make our little announcement.
Well, I think so. I'm going to let you do this one, Sarah.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I mean, this is a world exclusive, folks.
It is, as you heard it first here.
You did hear it first here. So this is just to really say that, you know, Nat and I love writing together so much, and we want our mutual love affair to continue. So we're already collaborating on our next book, which is going to be called On Progress with the Tudors. And we are going to be charting some of the most interesting and significant journeys of the Tudor era in full. And that will span the entire Tudor era. So we'll be picking out some of our favourites. And whilst that's one announcement, we also have another announcement. So in relation to that, what we want to do is to launch a podcast series. And this podcast series will be created by me as the Tudor Travel Guide and will be called On Progress with the Tudors Uncut.
Love it.
And and the uncut bit is that we're actually going to be sharing with you, good listeners, the progress of our researching and writing of the book as it goes along. So we're already underway, and what we're going to be doing shortly is putting together the first of that series of podcasts, and we'll be carrying on through the progress of writing the book. So you will literally listen as the book takes shape, and as we, i.e. Nat and I, share and debate what we're uncovering as we go along in our research. And hey, who knows, Nat, might be even opportunity for our listeners, your listeners, to get involved in the process.
I'd love that. That's absolutely an interactive, we were saying, an interactive, what's the word I'm looking for? An interactive edge, element, there you go, element to the podcast and to the book would be fantastic, because we know how knowledgeable our readers and our listeners are. That's the thing. So I think it's going to be a really exciting venture, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yes, vive la podcast.
Exactly. Now I want to move on, Sarah, and talk about lost Tudor palaces. Now here I go again. I'm going to tell another story because I just can't help it, really. So you might—I don't know if you remember the day that we went in search of the site of Nonsuch Palace.
How could I forget?
Yeah, how can you forget when we
arrived? I laughed a lot.
Yes, I know. I'm laughing now thinking about it. When we arrived at the park where the palace once stood, there was this, a group of men. I don't know if there was something on, but there was a sort of group of elderly men gathered there. And we asked a local man for directions to Nonsuch. And he obviously noted our enthusiasm in our voice and our look. And he responded with a somewhat quizzical look on his face. And he said, "You do realize," I can't do it in an English accent, but he said, "You do realize it's gone." Kind of just stared at us. And we just had a bit of a giggle. Because anyone that knows Sarah and I knows that we love standing in empty fields. That's actually what we do. It's part of the job. And we just like to imagine what once went on there. So talking about Tudor palaces, if you could bring back one of the lost Tudor palaces, which would it be, do you think, and why?
Oh, gosh. This is actually quite easy for me to answer.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, it's quite easy. Okay. It's Greenwich.
I'm feeling it'd be Greenwich.
Without a doubt. And I'll tell you why. There's a few reasons, but when I was writing LTV, Le Temps Viendra, I spent so much time in my mind's eye in Greenwich that literally I think I could walk you round it now if it was recreated and be a tour guide. Mm-hmm. I feel like I know the room so intimately. So to see them brought to life would be just incredible. You know, it almost feels like home. And one of my favourite chapters in the book is actually based at Greenwich. And that's the one describing Sunday, the 30th of April, when Anne knows she's fighting for her future and her life. It was a really emotional chapter to write. Mm. And so, yeah, just to be able to go back, I've actually nearly got a tear in my eye just thinking about it. Mm. That would just be amazing. And the other place I'd like to go is in Greenwich had in the King's apartments, which fronted on the river, there was a tower, the donjon. And it had, I think it was three or four floors. And one of the upper floors had the King's Privy Library in it. And of course, libraries at the time were incredibly rare. And I would just love to climb that staircase and just have a look round Henry VIII's private library. I mean, God, it just gives me shivers just thinking about it.
How fantastic.
And can you imagine standing in the, you know, the Queen's presence chamber, the place where Anne Boleyn was arrested, you know, where she had her last meal, you know, in freedom under her canopy of state before being taken to town. I mean, the events that have taken place there, you know, the birth of Henry VIII, of Elizabeth I, the arrest of Anne Boleyn, the marriage of Anne of Cleves. I mean, it just goes on and on. So from a historical perspective, I think, Greenwich all the time. Team Greenwich, that's me.
Team Greenwich, love it. All right. Now, before we wrap up here, because I think people have gotten the idea that you and I could talk forever. We could be 3 hours later, we're still here. So before we wrap up, I want you just to tell us a little bit about this new venture, the Tudor Travel Guide. I love it. I love the name. I love the idea behind it. But maybe if you just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, okay. So really, I suppose it's drawing upon a number of loves of mine, you know, the love of the Tudor era and places, my love of writing and my love of sharing all of this with others. You know, and it was a natural step to build on the research and writing that I've done today and bring all those passions together and create one blog, which is dedicated to being really your intimate guide to discovering castles and palaces and manors of Tudor England. You know, because I know in the past, one of my motivations for doing this is, you know, I visited somewhere and I bought the guidebook, but it doesn't really focus in enough depth on the Tudor era.
That's right.
You know, and I can't tell you how many times, you know, I've later found out, I've been to somewhere, then later found out there was an object or an artifact or something I should have seen that was enormous relevance to the Tudor story, and I've completely missed it. And so my aim is that my fellow Tudor time travellers will never again leave a place saying, "Oh, if only I'd known about."
Yeah, I love that. I love it.
Yeah. So, you know, the aim is to build up a wealth of knowledge, you know, about wonderful, fascinating, charming Tudor places to visit and look to lift the veil on as many hidden gems as possible. And, you know, and all the time trying to think about how I can make the visit as rounded and interesting. You know, so it's a bit like our style in the footsteps. It's a bit of a travelogue. Yeah, it brings in top tips, where to go, what to see, where to stay, where to get the best refreshment, etc. And I've also got, for those of you who love donning your walking boots and seeing history from a completely different angle, there's even a section on the blog about historic walks, which takes in Tudor properties on foot.
Fantastic. And it's an incredible resource. And I recommend that everyone go and have a look at the Tudor Travel Guide. Now, Sarah, are you ready to play 10 to go?
I'll give it a go.
You'll give it a go. Excellent. So these are just 10 quick questions. So, you know, don't take too long. Let's just go for it.
Okay.
Name two items on your bucket list.
oh, my God. Two items on my bucket list. One is going to Westminster Abbey Jubilee Galleries, which I am going to be doing in about 2 weeks' time.
Yes, you lucky. And
another one would be to reenact in costume at Hampton Court Palace.
Oh, who can make that happen? Anyone listening? okay, what do you do to recharge?
Meditate.
Yes, good. I'm with you on that one. Earliest childhood memory?
Sitting on the loo.
Thank you for being honest. That's what we like.
I'd go for the authentic route. Maybe not what you were expecting.
No,
but
that's fine. Name a favourite childhood book.
Yes, it was an Enid Blyton one, The Faraway Tree, the Magic Faraway Tree.
I love Enid Blyton. Describe your...
I think that was Enid Blyton. Anyway, Magic Faraway Tree.
I think definitely. It was, yeah. Describe your ideal Saturday night.
At home. I'm a bit of a home bird, I'm afraid. at home, just relaxing. My weeks are really, really busy. Yeah. And so just some downtime at home, pottering around with not many to demands, is actually my ideal Saturday night.
And that sounds good to me as well. What is something most people don't know about you? I think I can answer that one for you, Sarah.
Go on. You answer that.
I was going to say that you actually are a medical doctor.
Well, there you go.
You've told people now, but I don't think people would have known that beforehand. That's quite cool, I think.
Okay. Yeah, no, good one. Thanks for helping me.
That's all right. No problem. what is your guilty pleasure? What's one of your guilty pleasures?
Chocolate.
Yes, I know you like dark chocolate.
Copious quantities of chocolate.
Sounds good. We all love that. What was your first paid job? Do you remember what your first paid job was?
You know, I think it was literally when I started as a doctor. I didn't do any of the, you know, doing newspaper rounds or stuff like that. I was probably too busy studying,
I was too busy at McDonald's, working at McDonald's. Where's my next one? What's your drink of choice? If someone takes you out for a drink, what are you having?
Prosecco.
Yummy. And lucky last, your go-to karaoke song.
Dancing Queen.
Love it. Oh, that's good. I love that. Now, before I ask all my guests, before the conclusion of the episode, what is your Tudor takeaway? So just to clarify, this is just something that we can all explore after the episode. It might be a link to a website, a great song on YouTube, something that's going to nurture our love of Tudor history or maybe help us deepen our understanding about something. It can be anything you like.
Okay. Well, you know, I've got to do this, haven't I? I've got to say, go and see the Anne of Cleves panel at St. Leonard's Church in Bedfordshire. But why? Because if you don't know, during researching In the Footsteps of the Six Wives of Henry VIII, we uncovered, and I put that in inverted commas, uncovered or re-established a set of carved oak panels that exist in St. Leonard's Church in Bedfordshire as actually being contemporary to Anne of Cleves's life, and hitherto it was thought that they might have been from the 16th century or the 17th or the 19th century. Nobody really knew, but they're now a nationally important historic collection. And the thing is, you know, the reason why they're significant is that according to Jonathan Foyle, who helped us with the research, They are a really rare survivor of the domestic interiors of any of the royal, you know, the royal family of the time. Mm-hmm. And you can actually go along and touch them. They're not in a museum. They're right there for you to see and touch. And that's pretty rare. So that's my Tudor takeaway.
What a fantastic takeaway. Thank you so much, Sarah. This has been so much fun. Thank you for joining me on Talking Tudors. Like, as you know, we could talk forever, but this has been such a pleasure, and thank you very much.
You're most welcome. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself, and I hope your listeners have enjoyed this too.
All right, wonderful. Thanks.
Bye.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.